This episode is brought to you by Summer School Electronics. With pedals like the Snow Day Delay, the Pep Rally Fuzz, the Trash Panda, and my personal favorite, the Science Fair, which is two classic dirt pedals in one with a mid-boosted overdrive on one side, a black lab rat circuit on the other, and a blend knob to blend between them to find the perfect classic stacked dirt sound you're looking for, it's hard not to find something you'll love. Mark builds all of his pedals by hand in Syracuse, New York, where he also works as a full-time educator. In addition to the super fun graphics on their pedals, Mark also offers custom artwork. Want your dog's face on a pedal? He can do it. Want your face on a pedal? He can make that happen too. Go over to summerschoolelectronics.com and make sure to tell them that 40 Watt Podcast sent you. Forty Waters, welcome to a long overdue episode. I apologize. My life has been so wild the last few weeks. In fact, this one's happening a day late. It's okay, but we're getting this in. A lot of things to talk about today, a lot of things to go over. But first, I want to mention a podcast sponsor, Grez Guitars. Y'all, I have finally gotten my hands on a loaner. I did not buy this, y'all. I know y'all think I buy everything. This is a loaner. For the YouTube viewers, you can see this beautiful, ridiculously amazing Bass 6 from Barry at Grez. I may have a Fender Bass 6 that's for sale soon, and I got to find a way to get one of these. I'm going to have a video out on it soon, I hope. I did not know playing Bass 6 could be so much fun. So be on the lookout for that. Go over to Grez Guitars, almost at Barry from Grez. On Instagram, that's not his name. Grez Guitars over on Instagram. Follow Barry, what he's doing. Some of the raddest guitars. I own two. I've got this one on loan. I have another project I'm going to be working on with Barry later in this year. I'm super excited to get that one started. It's kind of a, I don't know, I'm putting together a bunch of pieces of my favorite things he does. Anyway, moving past that, make sure you go check out Summer School Electronics as well. I know you've already heard the spiel at the top of the episode, unless you're a Patreon listener. Go check out Summer School Electronics because Mark at Summer School is dropping a new pedal real soon on the 23rd. It's rad. I'm going to have a video out on that one as well. I like it a lot. I love the stuff Mark is doing, and I'm so thankful for his support on the show. I won't take sponsors who I don't like the things they make. That's just the way I do it. Look, I don't do this for a living. I do this to make a little extra cash every now and again through the sponsors to keep the show going, and I super appreciate that. So I get to choose that I only sponsor things I really, really genuinely like. Having said that, if you do want to support the podcast, go over to patreon.com/40wattpodcast. All right, moving on. That was super fast. Lots of nervous energy because I'm recording late, y'all, and I'm on a lot of caffeine. This week, I've got Scott from the Effects Loop podcast and just general shenanigans on the hanging out. We're going to chat. Scott, how you been?
I've been so busy.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
I'm so tired.
April and October are my worst months of the year. Absolutely are my busiest months of the year every year.
Tends to be in my industry as well. Spring break throws things weirdly off in that, but It did not slow down for me this year. But yeah, I've had a whirlwind of a month.
Yeah, you have.
I've had my birthday. Uh-huh. I've had my girlfriend's birthday. Mm-hmm. We have our anniversary. Uh-huh. And we got engaged.
Yeah, so I was going to correct you on girlfriend there.
Yeah, sorry, my ex-girlfriend.
You're now ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, she hates when I say that.
No, it's beautiful. That's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. If you're not telling that joke, you're not doing it right. Ladies, that's how you know your man loves you, when he refers to you as his ex-girlfriend and he's still with you. Just saying. For me, it's April is Blues Festival month. It's also National Library Week month. So day job gets a little busy. I don't know. And we do our big fundraiser, which is coming up next week as we record this. At the library, so that's going to take a ton of my time as well. Has been taking a ton of my time, so it's just one of those stressful time periods for me. And then October is just, it's the beginning of a new fiscal year at work, and it's like a bunch of conferences that I go to or speak at happen in October, so those months just get rough.
Oh, wow. My conferences are May and June.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense for you where you live.
Well, one's in New Orleans.
Oh, well then. I was going to say that's the guaranteeing good weather up in that region.
I'll be in New Orleans in June, and I will be in Ottawa, Ontario in May.
Really? Yeah. New Orleans in June, you say? That's not far from me. I'm always looking for an excuse to go to New Orleans.
Well, we'll talk.
We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about a few other things, listeners. So there's been some news that come out this week. So one of the beauties of having Scott on is that we don't do the traditional interview conversation type of podcast. We get to talk about some other things. And first, I want to talk about the incredibly sad news of the passing of Dickie Betts, which actually happened, I believe, today as we're recording. Was it yesterday? The 2 days are a blur. So I'm pretty sure it was today. I listened to the first three Allman Brothers Band albums today as a, you know, tribute. Yeah, it's a, I'm a big, big Allman Brothers fan. And while Dwayne gets a lot of the credit, obviously, Dickie Betts was the other side of that guitar attack. And I don't know. We see a lot of folks trying to do it, but it's really hard to beat the original sound of the Allman Brothers.
They really were they the first one to really do the dual lead guitar thing?
I don't have my history in line on this one, so there's going to be a bunch of listeners that want to yell at me. So let me preempt that by saying I don't 100% know, but I do know that the Allman Brothers, you had Skinner that was doing it a little bit. You also had Eagles were playing around with it as well. So I don't know who originated it. But the thing that's more interesting to me about the Allman Brothers doing it. So when you hear Skinner do dual guitar parts or harmonied guitar parts, it shouldn't surprise you because Skinner was scripted. Every lick, every note that Skinner ever played on a record was scripted. They were meticulous about how they put parts together. Whereas with the Allman Brothers, they were very improvisational, very jam, much more jammy. And so when you hear them come together to do harmonied guitar parts, it felt like this very different thing. They did script it. They had to have. I don't actually know this.
There's
someone
no
tell
way
me.
You can do Jessica with black right. improv, right?
Like, no. But all of the other sections are super improv heavy. And that's, I feel like that's always been the juxtaposition between those two bands because, you know, they sort of as a whole represent, you know, Southern rock. And where the Allman Brothers were very bluesy and improvisational, Skinner was very, I don't know, composed the way they did their music. You had to be with three guitar players, sometimes four on stage. So. But anyway, it's very sad, but he gave us some great music, and I listened to a whole bunch of it today, and I'll listen to a whole bunch of it over the weekend. I may actually finally sit down and start learning some of those solos that I've never bothered to learn.
Well, I mean, so they do a really good job, too, of the vocal solo. You sing along with it. Like, you can just kind of hum a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So, like, I bet you could probably just sit and figure a lot of them out.
Oh yeah, I know that I can learn. I know a lot of the riffs, like that first album, especially. A lot of the riffs were similar; just the rhythm was altered a little. Mm-hmm. I mean, on that first album, somebody's going to hate on me, even though I'm actually being complimentary. On that first album, it's very just pentatonic riffage for the main riffs of those songs. There's mm-hmm. not a lot of intricacies. Even the most iconic song off of that first album, which is Whipping Post. I mean, it's an absolute monster of a song.
That's almost a rock standard at this point, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. It's honestly a blues standard in some circles,
yeah,
too.
Like
so.
It's like one of the bluesy, rocky, folky mm-hmm. kind of circles. Like it's like everyone has a cover of that song little, somewhere or another. So,
and everybody, I love, because I was talking about it to somebody at a gig I had tonight. And it's interesting because, you know, that intro is in 11/8. It's oh yeah, it's do 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 do. That's real fast, but so it's in 11/8, but then it never does it. Once the vocals come in, they're in 12/8. They drop that two beat last pulse.
Mm-hmm. So do you count that 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2?
I would count it. So the way I learned to count triplets is 1, 2, 3, 1, 1, 2, 3, 1. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would count that. But then once, you know, I don't know that I need to listen to it again. I listened to it tonight, really trying to kind of pay attention. I don't know that they ever go back to that 11-8. I think it's just in the intro section that they're in 11-8, and then they go to 12-8 for the rest of the song.
It might be one of those accidental things.
Maybe, but it sounds great. It's got this cool, like, different, I don't know, it's real vibey. But even that one is very pentatonic based. The solo is very pentatonic based. I don't know, it's undeniably one of the greatest songs to me in rock and roll history. Whipping Post is such an incredible tune. I don't know, I enjoy playing it. I've got a gig next weekend at our fundraiser. I'm probably going to play it because I love that song. It's a ton of fun. I drop it a key, that's fine, because I don't want to scream out some of those things. So, fair. So Scott, we're well into, we're 3.5, we're going on 4 months into 2024. How has 2024 gear treated you?
It's been quiet, mm-hmm. but it hasn't.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of reshuffling for the most part with some gear.
Yeah.
So I have sold an amp. I've sold a guitar. I've sold two amps and a guitar. And I have now backfilled with a guitar and an amp.
Yeah. And we've talked a lot through this process, and I'm in the process. I sold a bunch of stuff earlier this year, and I also backfilled with an amp. And did I get an? I don't actually know. Two guitars. That's what I did. I did two guitars instead of an extra amp. Although I've picked up a couple of small amps just for flipping purposes. But yeah, I flip stuff, y'all listeners. It's okay occasionally. All flipping isn't bad.
So, I mean, there's so much gear out there for me that I'm like, I just want to try it for a little bit and then I'll mm-hmm. be done with it. And that's where I do a lot of my flipping these days, is just like, I just kind of want a free trial.
Yeah. Or at worst, you want to like pay a small rental fee mm-hmm. at the end of the day.
Yeah. Especially if you're doing the reverb circuit. But yeah, when you can find an off the beaten path deal, you know, it works out. So,
yeah. So I've noticed, and a lot of people have noticed because I've talked to a bunch of folks about this. The market is slow.
It's soft
right now. It's real soft. So if, listeners, if you're a buyer looking for something, now is your time. If you are looking to sell something, it's going to be a bit tougher right now.
But also if you're trying to sell something, you don't already have it listed, you're kind of missing your window. Because
yeah.
it is tax return season, which is mm-hmm. historically, this is usually one of the stronger parts of the season, particularly for like gear that people have been really wanting for a while or something like mm-hmm. that. I don't know about you, and don't want to go into too much details, but I would say my return this year was about a third of what it was last year's because of the new tax laws and the tax cuts going away and some of those kind of things. And you're quite used to, you know, I was probably getting like something around $1,200, $1,500 back. And I'd invest some of it. And then I'd, you know, fund money or whatever sometimes in my brain with it. You know, whereas like I got $500 this year, that's just dumping in my account. I'm not doing a big thing with it.
Yeah.
I also just bought a diamond ring. I'm about to move. Yeah. I'm planning a wedding. Like, oh, there's some incentives
to put money.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, a lot of my gear stuff is like, all right, I will be further whittling down my gear collection as I move and I don't live by myself anymore. So there's a lot of like space and quality seems to be where I'm kind of at right now.
Yeah. Zach over at Mythos and I talk a lot about gear selling and buying and trading. And he's got a phrase that he uses that I'm trying to break my brain to live by this mantra of less guitars, best guitars.
Like, I'm really starting to lock into just a couple of my guitars again. And actually, why don't we just dive that right into why I got a new guitar?
Yeah, so let's talk about how I pressured you into another guitar.
No, I don't think you pressured me.
No, I didn't.
But it is something
a little bit.
I mean, it's some stuff we've been talking about,
yeah.
Which is, I would say, as I'm getting older, and also just kind of given the climate, my stance on like not playing Gibsons has kind of gone away.
Yeah,
and I love Gibsons, like the sounds of them. I love them, but I have such a kind of fraught history of like, yeah, it's okay. You know, I never found the one. And we, you know, when you and I went shopping, goodness, almost a year ago now, that was Memorial Day last year, right?
Yeah, I think it sounds about right.
Yeah. So when we went shopping and I picked up so many Gibsons with you and I went, oh, these are all so wildly different. And you tell me, and you're like, yeah, there's not like, it's a lot easier to find a Strat and then find a similar Strat. And even there's variants and everything, but, or like particularly like, let's say a Paul Reed Smith. Paul Reed Smiths are very consistent guitars, right? And so like
everyone I've picked up, the ones that have the same neck profile, they feel like the same guitar.
Yeah. And that's my experience too, is like, so Paul Reed Smith, if you're thinking of getting one, go ahead, play one at Guitar Center and then go pick your favorite top at Sweetwater. Like it will be the same guitar. It'll be very consistently set up. SEs, maybe a little more variance in the setup, but the US models particularly. But as we were going through that, you know, we were talking through the Gibson thing, and I was like, I've always liked Les Pauls, and I really love the history of Les Pauls, and I love what they've done, but I've never been able to pick one up and go, I love this guitar. I've always picked one up and gone, yeah, it does the Les Paul thing.
Yeah.
And like, I love tracking with it for what the end result I get, but I just never loved picking one up. And so
it's because your back doesn't like picking one up. No, I get it.
I'm a big dude, so the weight of them doesn't bother me that much. And whatever. So I sold my Gold Top Tribute because, again, it was one of those, like, this doesn't spark joy. It just does the Les Paul thing.
I've been wondering when you would sell that for years at this point, because I knew that you almost never picked it up.
I only picked it up when tracking.
Yeah.
Or if I was playing rhythm guitar for somebody else. And even then, I didn't really love it.
Yeah.
So we started narrowing down. I went to some stores, just played everyone I could get my hands on and started lasering in. And then of course I turn around and find one for, and also I found one I loved, but I did not love what that store was asking for it.
Oh, that's right.
Cause it was out of my price range, but then I just started searching of, all right, what is that era? And surprise, surprise, I like Norlin era.
Yeah, you're Gibsons. The oddball that loves Norlin Gibsons.
They rip. They're awesome. And all the things that people hate about them are the things I like about them.
Yeah.
So I like the maple neck. I don't mind the weight. I love the volute. And so I got another 79.
Yeah.
So surprise, surprise, same years. Between Marlboro, my smoke-infested ES-335, and this one.
How's that one doing, by the way, with the smell? No more cigarette smell?
That one still has a little bit of a tinge.
Okay.
It's in there.
Yeah.
Also, I haven't, like, stuck a vacuum inside that F-hole, so.
Yeah.
There's stuff in there. This one, not so smoky. But it's also funny. This is a Nashville. These were made in Nashville. That was a Kalamazoo. But I really just kind of keep telling people, there's like, with Gibsons, you got to keep playing them until you figure out what you like.
Yep. Because the sound's kind of undeniable. Mm-hmm. Like, unless like you're the most niche guitar player ever, some of your favorite guitarists got their sounds with Gibson guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And just finding one that speaks to you, Joan of Heart from over at Pedal Playhouse, even she was like, no Gibsons, no Gibsons, no Gibsons. Then she found the one. She played the one that was like, oh shit, I like this. And so for me, it's those Gibson necks. I found that even the thinner Gibson necks, I tend to get along with more than I get along with any other necks. I do have a couple of other brands that, like, for example, I love the neck that Barry puts on his guitars, Grez guitars. It's incredible finish. It just feels like
a chunky neck.
I do like a chunky neck. The bass six baritone aren't as chunky. Yeah, I can't wait to play that one. I'll be in Chicago in August and for Fretboard Summit. By the way, listeners, if you haven't signed up for Fretboard Summit in Chicago, that is Fretboard Journal's little yearly gathering that they do. It is one of the coolest get-togethers, period, of just guitar nerds. And this year, performances from, I got to remember these, Blake Mills, Joe Henry, Valerie June. There's another big one that I can't remember off the top of my head. It's going to be a good time.
Colin Hay.
That's who I was trying to remember. So it's going to be a great time. Get your tickets now. Jason, I'll invoice you for this ad later. But
you got to play
or just get a discount. I've already paid for mine. It's fine.
I already paid for it once and didn't go because
I know
I got
right?
sick, but yeah,
that stinks. So, that's the thing with Gibson. I love Gibson guitars. I also have picked up a vintage Gibson guitar since the last time we talked. Got a chance to actually chat. I went to the Nashville Guitar Show. I'm trying to remember.
I knew you were going to come home with a guitar from that.
Well, I sold a bunch of stuff specifically to have money to buy. So I don't think I've had a podcast since I went. I think I recorded the last podcast with Terrence like the day before I left for that trip. So it released while I was in Nashville. And I sold my Amplified Nation. I had a Bombshell Overdrive. I sold that. And I sold like $3,000 worth of pedals because I was just like, I want money to buy. Because I went to that show looking for a vintage Gibson guitar.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted. Luckily, the Amigo Guitar Show in Franklin, Tennessee, technically, not Nashville. That was like Gibson heaven. Like, they had a lot of stuff.
No surprise, though.
Yeah, no surprise. Shouldn't be.
That's Gibson country.
Exactly. And so many. I played so many great guitars. I did not play one, but I held a 1957 Les Paul that was mint. They wanted $137,000 for it. But I got to play a bunch of really cool ones. I'll tell you what, the one that almost derailed me, because I knew I wanted, so I'll quit burying the lead here. I was hunting a 1950s ES-125 or an ES-150. I knew what I wanted. I saw some 150s. I saw a couple of cool ones, especially I went to Fanny's the day before the guitar show. Saw some really cool things there. I was in Nashville, listeners. I was already in Nashville for the National Show Choir competition. The show choir I play for got second. That's pretty dang good considering they never made finals before. I'm real proud of that. I got to play on the Opry stage, which is like,
dude,
bucket list checked off. I got to play on it twice. So I'm going to count that because we got to play first and then finals. And so after that first day of competition, the next day before we had to play at final, after we played finals, I went and checked out a bunch of stuff and I went to Fanny's, played a couple of 150s. I played a couple of a really great 225 that they had that I almost bought, but I decided I wanted to wait until the guitar show. And so I started hunting for a ES-125 or 150. If I got a 150, I knew I wanted one with the Charlie Christians pickup and not the P90. Cause I just like Charlie Christian and it seemed like a cool thing. But what I actually ended up finding in literally the very first booth I walked into was a 1965 ES-125 CD. And viewers on YouTube, you can see it in the background here. It's like a faded cherry burst. I'm not going to leave it there for too long, but, I've posted some pictures over on Instagram. You can check them out at 40 Watt Podcast. So it's a 125 CD. So a 125 as a standard model, the way it comes is no cutaway, one pickup at the neck, and it's a big, thick jazz box style body. So as you add letters, you add different features. So the options can be a T, which means thin line, which cuts it down to about the thickness of a 335. C, which is the cutaway. And then D, which is dual pickup. Mm-hmm. So mine is dual pickup, cutaway, but it has the full hollow body thing. And it's just absolutely monster guitar.
Well, also remember that the 335s also use those letters for a period of time there.
Oh, that's right. They do.
Because mine's a TD, and that doesn't stand for trapeze bridge. That's just
right, which is weird dual. Because technically, the only version of 335 was never actually made in a non-TD version.
At that era, they had a Nashville player or something like that that has three knobs.
Okay. But never in a thick body because it's a semi-hollow. Mm-hmm. So they never had a thick body version.
No.
Yeah, so it's interesting they kept that kind of...
I think they were just trying to standardize their...
I think that's what it was. I think everything. That was just them standardizing their naming system.
Yeah.
Wish they still did that. But yeah, so it's a great guitar. That guitar's case still smells like cigarette smoke. I haven't tried to get it out yet.
Leave it outdoors.
Yeah, I'm probably going to do that with some baking soda and do the whole nine yards.
Honestly, the baking soda thing, be careful.
No? Okay.
I don't think the baking soda really helped. Then the other beautiful thing is good luck getting that baking soda back out of what you spill it on.
So, I was just going to put one of those
pack, like the fridge pack
things? Yeah. Just put one of those in there and see if it'll do it. But I do need to clean that out. And so, man, I did not expect to adore that guitar as much as I do. It had the original. So they also came in three variants, one of which I can't understand. But so on top of the thin line, cutaway, dual pickup options, they also in 65 came in floating wood bridge with a wood saddle, floating wood bridge with a tune-o-matic saddle, and the uber rare, and I still can't figure out how it works, tune-o-matic screwed into the top. It's a fully hollow guitar.
They might have blocking there.
Maybe. That's the only way I can figure. They added some blocking to the top of it.
Get the depth you need for those thimbles.
Yeah. So, but most of them, mine's floating bridge. It had the ABR1 tune-o-matic on it.
Or they did a lock nut. What's the term I'm looking for? A riv nut.
Oh, maybe. Somebody will know. Somebody, if you're watching on YouTube and you know the answer, please put it in the comments below. I will check those. I'm really curious as to how that worked.
It's downward pressure. It's the lateral that you need the depth for.
Yeah. I don't know. But mine's Woodbridge. Pretty sure it's Brazilian rosewood bridge. So I've got the original bridge on it. I did order a wood replacement saddle because that's what I wanted, because I put flat wound strings on it. I've still got the ABR one.
I would take that bridge off immediately and just put it in its case for the rest of its life.
That's what I did.
Yeah.
And eventually I'll probably replace the actual saddles in the ABR one because they're so pitted from years of usage that they're too low. Strings were rattling against the bridge itself. And so,
yeah, I've been thinking about doing that with my 335. I've just, put it in its case,
nylon.
Let it live there.
Go nylon saddles. That's what I'm going to do if I ever put the bridge back on this one. Nylon saddles. So
we'll see.
But yeah, I sold a bunch of stuff.
And you're selling more stuff too.
I am selling more stuff. That's because of I'm scared to talk too much about it. That'll be something that's happening this Saturday.
Yeah, you're chasing a dream guitar.
I'm chasing a dream guitar. I did not expect to find one. It just popped up. And it's one of those very rare limited edition things that I'm like, I need to sell some stuff that I could replace if I ever wanted to. To get that one thing. And so I'm going to be driving to pick it up on Saturday, but I don't want to talk about it too much before those eggs have hatched. If you are listening to this after Saturday, April 20th, go look at my Instagram. If I have it, there are pictures there because I'm going to be posting some pictures and maybe some video of it. because I'm super excited about it. I need a new phrase, by the way. I'm tired of super excited. I say that way too freaking much. But selling stuff is hard right now.
I mean, yeah.
If you want to get even okay value from it.
There's price points.
Yeah.
And it depends what it is and all this other kind of stuff. So like, Philip has had me complaining about how hard it has been to move my Vox AC15 hand-wired. Mm-hmm. Just part of it's they reached a point, frankly, where their value got overinflated.
Mm-hmm.
It inflated a lot from what I bought mine at. And so, you know, it turned out to be a nice, you know, I had it for a couple of years and I got another 30% out of it, 40%, something like that.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, but it sat listed for a while and there were a lot of people kicking tires trying to come in low on it. So those things are soft. My Les Paul sold within a week.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. I did not see that coming.
It was a rare finish.
You had the gold finish in that tribute. I had a Sunburst tribute that took
a
little longer to sell than I thought it would.
Those are seriously selling for like $300 left.
I know. I got mine out for $800 a few years ago back when I had it, so I felt pretty good about that.
That's about what they're selling. $850 is what I'm seeing those for right now.
Yeah.
Whereas like people are seriously asking like $1,400 for the gold ones right now.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported in part by String Joy Strings. I'm a snob, at least that's what people tell me. I'm never okay with good enough, and that's where String Joy Strings come in. They're better than good enough. They're the best. String Joy are making some of the finest strings available today right up the road from me in Nashville, Tennessee. They offer custom sets, balanced tension, coated strings, the works. If you need it, they can probably make it happen. You should be using String Joy Strings, and if you're going to order from them, you really could help this podcast out by clicking the affiliate link down in the description or show notes below. You get amazing strings, I get a little bit of that back to help the show keep going. It's a win-win situation. Get your String Joy Strings today. Well, you know, some folks are really trying to lean in on this buying thing right now. And if you've got the funds, it's the time to do it. Like, I listed my Jason Isbell Telecaster. I listed it for sale as of this podcast going out. I don't know if it's still available. If you're interested, find me over on Facebook and we can chat. Or message me on Instagram. But I listed my Isbell Telecaster because, once again, I'm selling things that I can buy again. If I want, I can get another Jason Isbell Telecaster.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of them out there. But I put it on Reverb, cause I have a hard shell case for mine. And I think I'll just go ahead and say y'all, as of 2024, I listed it April 18th, for $1,300, which I think is a pretty good price considering I get a hard shell case with mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I bought it. And I immediately, within a half hour, had someone offer me $800. Or whatever the 64% mark is on Reverb.
I mean, I know who those people are though. Like, there's like three stores that like almost always give you a low ball within a day of listing it.
Yep. Because they're just buying stock, and I get it. Shoot your shot, because sometimes somebody will take it. I'm not mad at them, mm-hmm. but that's where we are. People are trying to take advantage of that very soft market and they're coming in really low. I have also become a pro of opening a calculator and finding out what 64% of someone's listed price is.
So I'm pretty sure it's a bot.
I could see that. But yeah, so it's a tough time to sell right now, but it's good to buy. But speaking of selling, there's been a couple of things in the market that have happened that I think are really, really interesting. Number one, we talked about this a little bit. Marshalls are finally available in the US at essentially the UK price point. That's on the heels of a report that I've not read the entire thing of. I've read the same blurb that everybody's read about how the company that now owns Marshall says that amp sales are only 5% of their total sales. I don't know what that actually means because they don't give us any more info.
I mean, they were a consumer electronics company that licensed the name Marshall.
Yep.
Sold a crap ton of, I see a lot of the over-ear headphones. Mm-hmm. With people.
I see a lot of those little Bluetooth speakers.
Those Bluetooth speakers. I've known some people who have had them. And that's not the only product they make, like the Marshall licensing. They have everything else.
Yeah.
And so I can see how them just going, all right, we're tired of licensing the name of Marshall. These are selling well. It's a lifestyle brand. We're liking it. Let's just grab the whole thing. Oh, by the way, we make electronics, so it wouldn't be crazy to do the amps and stuff too.
Yeah.
Because no one wants a new Marshall. Everyone wants the same old Marshalls. They just want them cheaper.
Well, that's also because Marshall's not been great about making. The Studio series has been the hottest thing new they've made in a long time because they tried to dabble in some things that I think were just lunacy and outside of what they do.
What, the Mode 4 wasn't your ideal amp?
The Mode 4, you had that digital monstrosity they tried to make.
Yeah, everyone tried to do solid state amps in the 90s, though.
I know. And they tried to do them more recently than that. And I was just like, this isn't what you go to Marshall for.
They sold a crap ton of MG heads and cabs. Yeah.
Yeah. But what's been their best selling amp of the last 15 years? The DSL 40. I mean, though they sold just a bajillion of those. A great PCB entry point dual channel tube combo.
It's a better option than the Hot Rod Deluxe.
Exactly. It's Marshall's Hot Rod Deluxe, which the Hot Rod Deluxe, the best-selling Fender amp maybe of all time.
Honestly, if they would just put a decent master volume circuit on the Hot Rod Deluxe.
I agree.
And took away that drive section. I don't know why they keep.
Yeah.
It's like no one at Fender knows how to design an amp anymore.
Well, you could always get the I had one. It's a DeVille, not a Deluxe. Landau DeVille.
Mm.
You ever seen one of those? Mm-hmm. It has two clean channels. You could just set them differently. And so it was cool. I bought it to flip it because somebody was selling it way too cheap. Actually, a store was selling it way too cheap.
They did a Bonamassa hot rod as well.
Did they really?
Wasn't it like they did the high power twin, and then I thought they did Bonamassa versions of everything. So
yeah, I mean,
they did a hot rod Bonamassa as well.
They may have. I just don't remember it. Let me see. I see an article. I'm not going to do the like complete. Anyway, I'll look it up. Somebody can tell us we're wrong or not. But they also did a George Benson DeVille. So those are cool. But the big deal is, to me,
they did not fact check myself on the fly. Wrong. It was just the two.
Okay. The DeVille. I mean, the Marshall price drop though is bringing them more in line with one the UK pricing. Two, a little closer to what their competition is pricing at. They were pricing at a premium only in the U.S.
And the reality is Friedman probably more so
was
than
eating their lunch and taking their money.
Was making a more reliable tour-ready amp with the features people wanted for a cheaper price. And then, Paul Reed Smith's HDRX series was pretty solid. The HDRX's pricing is kind of weird at the same time. Like, the 100-watt amp is quite expensive still, but the 20-watter is really affordable and has a lot of features people actually want.
Yeah.
And the other weird part is 20 watts, if you're cranking a Marshall, is kind of what you want. I'm not sitting here just rubbing one that literally showed up yesterday that I paid $500 cash for.
Yeah. And to be honest, it's still the better option than even at the new price. So the Marshall Studio Vintage 20, the Plexi 20 watt,
mm-hmm.
is $1,299. It was $1,749 before the price drop. Whereas the HDRX 20 is $800.
Yeah, and the Friedman has a 20 watt in that range too, don't they?
Oh, yeah. The Runt.
Yeah.
Friedman Runt, let's 20
for $1,500.
Yeah, $1,400. So Marshall brought it above the PRS, but cheaper than the Friedman now.
They had to.
They had to. If they wanted to stay viable, they absolutely had to. Now, as someone who just bought a Marshall, albeit at a great price earlier this year, it made what was a smoking deal that I got. It's a good deal now. It's not an amazing deal. But
I always kind of wondered a little bit, that was that just Marshall being cheaper in the UK. Obviously, power in the UK is different, so you can't you can't just buy them and bring them over here the way you can with like paddles and some of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. The 9-volt is standardized across the world, but mains power is not. How much of that might have just been a little self-serving of just like, we want British artists playing the British amps? And
we'll be right back. If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
That's sort of what I've always speculated it was, is that they were, because honestly, there's no reason, we were talking about this just before we started recording, so I wanted to pull up an example, right? Mm-hmm. The amp behind me, if you're watching on YouTube, is a Marshall 1959 HW. That's their hand-wired 100-watt plexi. Just good old-fashioned, crank it and go. I have an attenuator on it, which is the only way I can run that thing. Mm-hmm. And so, before the price drop, that amp new was $3,850, $3,849. With the price drop, it is now $2,499, a price drop of $1,350. I mean, that's a third of the price they took off. It's more than a third. It's a little more than a third of the price.
Yeah.
So I decided, hey, what does a 59 HW sell for in the UK? Well, they have one at Guitar Guitar, brand new, for £1,899. And I did the conversion. That comes out to $2,358. You add in shipping costs from the UK to the US, you're sitting at the same price point, mm-hmm. $2,500.
I also wonder how much did Victory play a hand in this too?
See, we had Friedman over here eating Marshall's lunch. I wonder if that was a big deal. Victory was absolutely
like Victory finally got distribution in the US in the last like 2 years. So
it's picked up, but I bet in the UK is a much bigger deal. And they were just, I did not pull up any comparisons to like a, what would the Victory Sheriff be, the comparable?
Sheriff 22 is $1,430.
Yeah. Do they have a 100 watt amp at Victory? Yeah, they have the Super Jack. And they have a Sheriff 100, which is $2,250. They have a 100 watt Marshall, quote unquote, at $2,250. Marshall had to catch up and bring their prices more in line with what other people were charging to do the same thing. And like, I'm a sucker for nostalgia and doing it the way they did it in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. So I got a 59 hand wired with no effects loop and just got to turn it up and go. But the other company, you know, a lot of people want an effects loop in an amp like that. They want some modern conveniences like the HDRX. You want an effects loop. Mm-hmm. And so
and
these
I
other
don't
companies
have to use a jank little bridging jack
yeah,
either.
Yeah, that's true. I do the bridging, the four jack bridging. But I like it. It's fine.
It's aesthetic.
It's aesthetic. Yeah, and look, there's a complete and utter first world privilege and problem of being able to have a half stack in a 11 by 11 room like I am right now and be able to actually turn it up every now and again, most of the time with an attenuator. And I love it. I love having that thing. I love playing it. I'm still trying to talk a buddy of mine into doing a Zeppelin tribute gig with me so that I can actually gig it at least once. Otherwise, that thing's never leaving the house. It's just not. That's not an amp I'm taking to a gig. I would. It's not like I'm babying it. It's just there's no gig I'm playing that warrants that amp. It's in complete and utter vanity. Whereas the other companies were putting out things at reasonable prices that you could gig that were usable and absolutely taking Marshall to school. And I think in this climate of amps not being the hot ticket item or as necessary as they used to be, you got to meet people where they are.
I think there's a few things in there of smaller, lower powered amps, but people are buying more and more and more of them. So yeah. Like maybe it's just the age I'm in and who I'm looking at. Mainly my friendship with you, but I've seen a lot of guys now just do lots of amp heads and not as much the cabs as we used to be. Mm-hmm. And I think the prevalence of IRs, things like Two Notes, things like, frankly, having cab IRs and dummy loads in amplifiers becoming a more standard feature now. And the more modern amps, so like Rev and a few of those, Soldano, Soldano did it with their, not the SLO, but the other new one they just came out with.
I can never keep up with them.
But that's becoming a more commonplace feature. I think PV mm-hmm. did it with the Invective.
Ashdown's doing it in their guitar amps now.
Yeah. So it's
not that they're like the most massive guitar company, but I'm thinking of amps that are putting in. Sir does it in one of the Pete Thorne models, I think.
Yeah. So all that to say, it's becoming a more common thing to have a reactive load and have sort of the silent amp head and then have a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a lot of YouTubers with the shelf with all the different ones. I might be doing that. We'll see.
Yeah.
Now that I'm swimming in amp heads, I never had an amp head until last year. And now.
Yeah. Now they're just all over the place.
Yeah.
Although you did sell one of them. You sold one of them.
I sold the little brother because I bought the big brother. But yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, my amp collection's getting out of hand. And the funny part is all I do is I mess with them. I love playing with them at home, but I'm still profiling them and throwing them in a modeler and going out with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
whereas I'm dragging my amps out to gigs and only, you know, my back only a little bit resents me for it.
Yeah, but then my tubes don't go out. If my gear gets stolen, I still have a backup of all the files. So I can just go buy another Kemper or Quad Cortex. Yeah. And frankly, it's the same amount of money. So I'm not that heartbroken if one disappears, you know? So
I am absolutely asking the universe to laugh at me by saying this. So I'm going to knock on wood. Ask me how many times I've ever had a tube amp go out on me on a gig.
Once? Never?
I've
had one.
I've had an amp go out. I've had a couple go out. No, I take that back. I had an issue with tubes, with some new tubes that were kind of trash. But those weren't at a gig. The only tube amps I've ever had go out were the house amps at the club I used to run sound at. And they just were played 5 nights a week, every week, you know, except for some holiday weeks. And so those were inevitable. Those were going to break.
We'll be right back.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. Look, we all artists, man. We gonna have this like
bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real. I gotta lie.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
I've had mostly tubes, you know, just tubes burn out and they go pad or they finally kick the bucket.
Even think of that as a problem.
Yeah. And I've had rectifier tube go out on my Super Reverb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've had preamp tubes go out of my Super Reverb. I've had a preamp tube go out and start buzzing on my Vox, which has been replaced. And that was mostly because that's back when I left that Vox in the amp room at my church and someone else used it and left it on.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like I've had like catastrophic failures, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what this is going to do for Marshall. At first, I was worried this was like a clearance situation, like mm-hmm. a death knell situation. Like, oh, let's just get rid of this stuff because now we're not going to do this anymore. But it hasn't seemed like that. I haven't gotten that vibe of desperation. It's more of a, this is the new normal. Mm-hmm. This is us resetting. Do you remember when JC took over at Gibson in 2019 and they revamped the whole line to be a little more in line with the traditional specs? They brought the standard back to be the standard, and they also cut the price significantly. They brought them all down to $24.99. Of course, they're back up in the $27.99, $29.99 range, depending on your options. This has that feel to it of, hey, we kind of screwed up. Let's go back to what we're good at and put it at a price where people can afford it.
I think Fender is about to go through something like that on their guitar side.
Yeah, I think I think some of it's getting a little out of hand. I'm sorry. I'm gonna be that guy. I know some of them are artist models, but like a $2,000 made in Mexico Strat is just absurd to me. I know it's an artist model, so I know some of that money goes to the artist, but that is an absolutely absurd price, even today with the inflated prices. Like $1,200, $1,300, whatever. That's fine. That doesn't bother me.
Well, but considering $2,000, Gibson, Paul Reed Smith both put out American-made versions.
Yep.
Of guitars. Now, bear in mind, this is kind of one of the topics I've wanted to talk out loud with you because we keep texting about it. There's a few different price points in different markets. So we've been kind of hovering around that $1,500 amp head, low mm-hmm. power amp head kind of market. Yeah. And for whatever reason, Fender still avoids amp heads. I don't know why, but they just stopped.
Yeah.
Even though
they don't care. It used to be their bread and butter. That was it.
Bandmasters.
And then then the combo came at, you know, Basement, Bandmaster.
The Deluxe Reverb, I think, really kind of broke it. And then the Princeton got more popular, and that broke it further. And now Champs are out of whack, too. So
I know for a fact, because I've seen them. I don't know if it was like a one-year thing or it was one store's
the Deluxe
special.
Reverb head?
Yeah, Deluxe Reverb head. Why does that not exist?
Seems like easy money.
It seems like printing money.
Well, and that's also something I've been playing around with. You know, as you've had me go into this round of amp head stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly I became very aware of, wow, the cab matters a lot more than I always just took for granted. Speaker went with amp.
Yeah.
Because I played Fender combos. I never really messed with speakers. It was never really an option. Right. I mean, it was, but
that's because your Super already has the greatest speakers that Fender ever put into an amplifier.
Ah, so we can talk about that a little bit later, but I'm starting to lean towards no on that.
Oh, no, the CTSs are the best speakers Fender ever put.
But like, so anyway, I've been doing profiles of my Super Reverb with 22 something different amp combinations or cab combinations. And I was just going through all the different things, all the different Jensens, the EVs, the JBLs, the Scumbacks, Greenbacks, every single kind of main permutation that people put into stuff. And there's so much volatility in what you do with a speaker that it's for whatever reason, Fender seems to really enforce their tones. And it's kind of imagine if you could only get a Greenback with a Marshall.
Yeah. And that was your only option.
Yeah.
And only this very specific, like, so same thing, just a quick aside. When I started looking for a cab for this Marshall, I went down the rabbit hole.
Did you go down the Greenback rabbit hole?
Oh, yes. So I wasn't going to buy a vintage cab, but I also started to go down the rabbit hole. Oh, I'll just get a 1960A. It's going to be fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I listened to him, and I was like, oh, no, that's not it. And I was like, oh, well, I need this sound then. Mm-hmm. And I like ended up going down the rabbit hole of, oh, that's when I realized, oh, greenback is not a greenback is not a greenback.
Yeah. Like, and then you try to figure
there's the 25 watt, there's the 30 watt, there's the vintage versions.
And there's like, the 65 hertz, the 75 hertz, the, you know, all the different things. Then you can get into scumbacks, and then you can get into all the different things. It's wild what's there and out yeah. there. Anyway, tangent aside.
Yes.
So we talked about that part. We're also seeing a couple battles starting to kind of form in some interesting areas of price point, which is sort of that $1,500 guitar has been something a lot of the, I will say, the foreign made guitars are starting to creep into. Fender went full into it with the artist models coming out of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Epiphone is pushing into the $1,500 price point now with
yep.
their custom shop inspired buys. And they're giving you features back that you wanted, like, frankly, really expensive pickups.
Yeah. Great pickups, great electronics in general.
The headstock design that people want.
Custom finishes that aren't available on the standard line.
Yep.
And a lot of people are like, I can't believe anybody would ever pay $1,500 for an Epiphone. That's fine. Don't. It's not like they got rid of their $800 Les Paul or their $600 Firebird. You can still get the inspired by Gibson Epiphones.
I mean, it's going to be hard to shake the $300 Les Paul standard used mentality the same way
yeah.
Fender can't shake the $300 Fender Strat.
Yeah, dude.
They just can't shake that image. And like a player Strat now is what, 800, 900 bucks?
You know what? I think it's higher than that.
The player Fender,
what do they call that? The Ventura series?
Well, that's the Ventura. I'm just trying to say, like, what we used to call the Mexican Strat is now the player series.
Okay. So yeah, it's actually they're marked down currently, some of them are. So yeah, $800.
Yeah. That's the new price point. And then so the $800 price point, there's some interesting battles going on. You get the mm-hmm. you get the Paul Reed Smith CE or SE series in that price point. Epiphone has some great options in the $700, $800 range. My co-host over at the Effects Loop, Diaz, has that Jerry Cantrell
Les
Paul Custom Wino. That was like $800, $850. Fantastic guitar for that price point.
You know, just a plain old Les Paul standard, Epiphone Les Paul standard is $700. That's a great guitar.
Yeah. And that's $700, $800. That's sort of that price point now for that standard second guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Arguably, your second guitar might be like a classic player Strat from Squire. But, you know, if you really think like your first guitar.
A classic vibe, you mean?
Classic vibe, sorry. Yeah, you have like the 150 points for some reason has still stayed 150, which is nuts. But, you know, you're all in $300. I'm going to start playing guitar. That's a Squire. That still is a Squire. Your second guitar might be a nice Squire, or they've tried to differentiate that the nice Squires were outplaying the Fender Mexico. So they upped the Mexico quality, and they did. There's QC issues galore in Fender's realm, but arguably it's a better guitar. There's better pickups. There's, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah. At least on average, it's a better guitar.
And then you run up into where $1,500 used to be an American Strat. It's not anymore. Those are priced out. Those are $2,000 plus. Yeah. You're getting, you know, fancy Mexican models with customizations and stuff like that. But you're watching Paul Reed Smith battle over that area because they had the S2s, and that's kind of been the maligned a little bit. I've had a hard time wrapping my head around the S2s because it was still the SE's pickups.
Yeah, exactly.
But they were US made, and so they were nice. But it's the same thing like Gibson was doing, where like, they're making an okay guitar, but it's compromised in some way to hit this price point. And Gibson seems to be saying, well, we're going to just make Epiphone up into that with some premium models and really push that as a premium space to the detriment of the Studio and the Tributes and a few other models range.
The Studio's gone. They discontinued the Studio.
I don't think they did.
Yeah. No, Les Paul Studio didn't exist.
You sure about that?
Uh-huh.
I thought they made a new Studio.
They made a They've still got some in stock, but I'm pretty sure they nixed the Les Paul Studio. The line is gone. It's now the something modern light.
They have the modern studio. It's not a studio. Is the new one.
Yeah.
And that's just sitting at $2,000. And it's really, it's a studio. But it lets them play with modern features that people want while without touching the Gibson Les Paul standard, which is...
Yeah, exactly.
The flagship and the... For whatever reason, they can't figure out like a Les Paul Classic, if they would just make the Les Paul Classic a nice guitar instead of a compromise guitar.
Yeah.
And there was a period of time where the Classic was nicer than the standard in the 90s. So anyway, they moved that name around. So you're watching that. So Paul Reed Smith turns around and says, we're going to up the pickups on the S2s. They increased the price point by about 200, 250.
Yeah, that was a big deal to me, the price change.
But the pickup quality is significant.
Yeah. No, it's a big deal. But to me, like the other thing you're looking at, so I'm going to price these low to high, the S2. So the most affordable S2 you can get right now is the S2 Satin Standard 22. And it comes in at $1,500. But as you go up the line, and I've had a standard, I can't remember if mine was a standard 22 or 24. It was a good guitar. I liked it. I've had an S2 Vela. I've had the S2 594, all within the last year.
You like the 594 a bit, didn't you?
I do like the 594. There's only a slight issue I have with the 594, and it's just getting used to that scale length. It didn't react to certain string gauges the way I thought it would, like the traditional Logic. And so it didn't work out for me ultimately. Ultimately, what I wanted was a Les Paul. Let's just be honest. But yeah, some of these S2s, it took them into the like $2,400 range.
Mm-hmm.
And
also to think like that's an area that used to be like the CE24 sat in, and now the CE24 has gotten more expensive. Mm-hmm. The Silver Sky has gone up by about $400 or $500 over the years. Without any real changes to the Silver Sky.
Yeah.
Allegedly, there are like secret things that the John Mayer guys really get into.
That's a whole crowd that I can't.
It really is. It's like,
yeah, they're wild.
There's some cork sniffing going on there. And then there's like the Dead Spec one and then all the other things there. And yeah, you've watched Paul Reed Smith inflate prices all across the board. They really seem to have come in at a really nice quality to price point. Recapture a lot of goodwill in markets because they were able to finally shake the new metal and ostentatious dentist vibes to get a lot of more normal players, I think, back in the fold.
They have finally it took them a long time to get past that new metal vibe for me. It didn't matter what they did. Like I constantly that's what I had in my
head. It's funny to me because the new metal guys all played like flat finish guitar parts mess.
Yeah.
And they don't make flat finish Paul Reed Smiths anymore. That's kind of the funny part about it to me.
Like, yeah. No, they really don't.
Well, they've done some satins like
that brand new one, that really cheap SE that they made. And I say cheap dollar wise, not quality wise.
It was the CE24 SE.
Yeah.
And they also made an American version of that too, where it's a satin all mahogany. That's what my buddy Ian bought. Mm-hmm. And that had the 57 pickups, not the 85s.
Okay. Also, PRS pickup numbers just in one ear, out the other.
Well, they couldn't name it a PAF, so 57 is the name.
Neither can Gibson, so.
I do wish they just kept calling the 85s Dragons.
Yeah.
But, oh well.
It's a weird battle to watch as companies try to capture a market, like a very specific point. And the thing that's getting tougher to me, that as some of the mainstream companies are battling up. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where I talk to people all the time, like, I can't believe this Murphy Age ES335 is, $8,000. So don't get a Murphy Age ES335. Buy the Epiphone 335 or buy the standard Gibson ES335.
If you want something that relict, go get a vintage one.
Yeah.
honestly, that's one of the other really hilarious things about Gibson purists is like player wear Gibsons don't carry any value. They're cheap.
It's weird.
They're really cheap.
And we're using the cheap term cheap relatively speaking.
I got a 79 Les Paul Standard for $2,300.
Yeah.
That's how much a current Les Paul Standard used costs.
Mm-hmm.
There is no vintage tax at all. Now, bear in mind, tuners are replaced. There's a weird speed hole in it. It's relicked. The finish was peeling. You know, there's some things I had to do there to kind of save it. It had, that guy had a, there's a hole here, right here. They had a 335 strap pin on it. Why? That's the worst part about a 335. Now, do I?
Yeah.
This is where it's comfortable. I don't know why they did that. But yeah, you can see here, like there's wear, there's pitting. It's, this thing's been beat up.
And y'all, he said ES335 for $2,300. He meant his Les Paul.
Yeah, I got my Les Paul for that. My ES,
because I know what you paid for the 335.
Slightly more. Still a good deal. Yeah. Still a good deal.
Still a great deal. Yeah, it's just go.
Go play.
Just gotta hunt.
Find played Gibsons that someone's spouse is getting rid of.
I mean, don't get me wrong, because like I just did a quick Google search for 79. '79 Les Pauls, and
they get up there.
Yeah,
the Les Paul here's customs, one on, particularly thanks to Adam Jones.
Here's one on Reverb in the burst, like yours. Dual cream pickups, though. Doesn't have the extra cavity hole. It's got some. It's got wear and tear. I'm not going to go through this whole listing, but it's up for $6,000.
Yeah. I'm thinking about putting just a switch in it that does nothing. Like, what's his name?
Oh, the like a producer player? Switch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, brain.
Is it Lee Majur?
No, it's Sklar. Sklar,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Lee Sklar.
Lee Sklar.
Sorry, my brain was going to just explode if I didn't get that out. The deals are out there, especially right now. If you're hunting things and you have the expendable income, don't go into debt buy gear, y'all. Mm-hmm. I have done that song and dance, and it's not a good place to do things.
You only need one good guitar.
Yeah, there's no need to do the insanity that I have, the hole I have dug myself into.
Honestly, if I just did the one guitar, one amp thing, I'd probably be sounding a lot better than I do right now.
Mm-hmm. I have a list on my computer of if I were forced to go down to two or three guitars and one amplifier, and I know what I can go down to and be completely happy playing guitar. Everything else is superfluous. I did it for 10 years. I can go back to it if I need to. I won't like having to sell off some stuff because I like it. I like having it, and I'm not hurting anybody having it. So my guilt for having it's gone. But if I had to, I could get rid of it all and go down to just what I need to play the gigs I play and be happy. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. So a fun thing to kind of chat about in this is who are these for?
Oh, yeah.
Right, because obviously we're in kind of a recession. We're really in like a inflation recession, which is a weird thing, and we're not going to get into the full economics of what that all is, but
because that's complex too,
because the economy keeps growing, so it's not a real recession, right? But it feels like it for a lot of people because things are getting more expensive and it's harder to get at, right? Typically in a recession, brands that survive are the luxury brands, because you know who doesn't feel a recession are rich people. What's interesting, what I've heard about this is a lot of these plays, the higher end Epiphone, the PRS S2s, a lot of that, it's not really, the brands aren't necessarily viewing them as this is us getting people into their third guitar. Where I think a lot of us would typically think of those guitars.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, the aspirational, you know, that's your, I just graduated from college, I can finally have a good paycheck, I'm going to buy a good guitar kind of person, or like a high school graduation, or like, you know, some of those like life turning points of someone who's been playing for a bit.
right.
Been making something work.
They're like, I've been playing guitar for 10 years. It's time to get a real, quote unquote, guitar. Mm-hmm. I'm not calling any more affordable guitar not a real guitar, but that's like the mindset.
Honestly, yeah. And yeah, if I was a diehard gigging musician, there's a good chance I'd be playing something cheaper. But that's right. So that's that side of it. I play at church, so I get to have fancy stuff because it doesn't really go in a hostile environment. What's interesting about this is often when you think about these entry levels for these luxury brands, right? So let's call it Gibson a luxury brand. Epiphone coming up into the Gibson price point, it's the perception of luxury. And remember, Epiphone has tried this before. Remember the Ultra series?
The Elite and the Elitist series.
Yeah. So they've tried to push this.
Oh, in the Master Built series.
Yep. They've tried to push this boundary. Yeah, they've tried to push this boundary up. This one finally seems to be catching, and I think a big part of that is the artist model for the Dave Grohl opened public up to that because we can't afford a real custom shop Gibson or Gibson Dave Grohl.
Well, I think on top of that, you also, just to add to that a little bit, there was the Greeny, there was the Adam Jones, there was the, you know, they're bringing out those artist models in that, you know, $1,200 to $1,500 range.
Yeah. They're technically R59, technically. Yeah. That's where they're pushing. And what it really is strategically, historically, that's your entry point. That's your BMW 3 Series, your BMW 1 Series. The idea is you buy one of those, and then you go get an X5 once you have a family, and then you go. At some point, you get the 750, or you know, as you age up into the brand and your income goes up, you keep buying into the brand, right? And you buy fancy.
And then
stuff.
Eventually, you hit that midlife crisis. I have money moment, and you buy the whatever. I think that's a Porsche, the Boxster.
Well, so that's actually somewhere one. If you've wanted a Porsche your whole life, you go get a Boxster or a Cayman, and then you hopefully one day you get a 911. And then you get that you just get a 911, and then you go for a GT3, or, you know, you work your way up into the crazy exclusive Porsches. You know, there's that.
We've exhausted my car knowledge at this point.
And, but like, that's, you know, if you buy a Murphy Lab, that's not your first Gibson.
No, at least I hope it's not.
Probably not.
Holy
shit,
I hope it's
chances not. Chances are, you know, a lot of people's first Gibson is still a Les Paul Standard or a 335 or an SG Standard. That is your on road into Gibson is usually, I want the real thing. I'm going to finance it or whatever when I get in. Mm-hmm. And
you might go used. My first Gibsons were all used guitars.
Probably a good idea. We're, you and I are both big used guitar advocates.
Absolutely. Every time.
So that's people's first Gibson. The S2s, these high-end Epiphones are actually people's second or third Gibson. That's what they're trying to get. They're trying to capture that guy or girl who has a custom 24 and kind of just wants something that's like, they want to mess with a McCarty, but they don't want it to have two core model PRSs.
Right.
So I think it's backwards in my brain, but it does also make sense of what they're seeing with buying trends and what's going on.
I think the same way, especially when they started with the Firebirds. So it didn't like they discontinued the Epiphone inspired by Gibson Firebird. If you still just want the two Firebird pickups, Sunburst, Firebird, that guitar is still available for $650. I think it's gone up to $650. It was like $599 or maybe it's $700 now. I don't know. That's fine. That guitar still exists for you. But if you're already kind of a Gibson player, or you're already a guitar player with a collection of four or five guitars, and you're like, oh, I've always wanted a Firebird. I don't want that standard finish. I want something fun and cool and different. Hey, here's these more expensive, but also a little more unique Firebirds. Whereas if you want that finish or that style Firebird in a Gibson, you're buying a custom shop, or you're buying vintage, like hard to find finishes, which some of the new Epiphone finishes, I'm not sure they ever made a Firebird in that finish. So the options you couldn't even get if you wanted to.
I mean, I'll admit, I kind of just go blind when I start seeing a Gibson that's not a Les Paul or a 335.
I like them all.
It's like when new Telecasters come out, I just kind of just stop looking.
I kind of wish I'd picked up a Challenger 3 when they were dirt cheap. It would be my strat. So, we could keep talking about this, and we are going to talk about this more, but we've blown past the hour mark. We're going to move on, and we're going to go talk about this a little more on the Patreon episode of the podcast. But listeners, make sure you click the links below. I'm going to put some links to Effects Loop, to some other things we're talking about. You got links to all the sponsors down below. You got Summer School Electronics. You got Grez Guitars. There's some other info down there. Y'all, there's a lot down there. I don't remember what all I put there anymore. So go read the notes in the description below. And we'll talk more. Scott, thanks for coming on this week and talking gear.
Happy to be here. Glad we finally found something that worked out. We've been talking about getting together for a couple of weeks now.
I know. And we may do a few more episodes this season just because they're really fun. Just chat about the industry, state of the industry, instead of trying to do the interview thing. And so we'll get some more stuff like this going. So y'all make sure to go follow Scott. And in the meantime, be good to yourselves, be kind to each other, and make some noise. This episode is brought to you by the supporters of 40 Watt Podcast over on Patreon. Go over to patreon.com/40wattpodcast, where for as little as $3 per month, you can help support the podcast and get every episode ad-free. For $5 a month, you'll get every episode ad-free, as well as a bonus episode every week. I can't overstate how thankful I am for the support of my patrons, and hope you'll consider joining the team and helping keep this show on the road.